And there's, you feel so helpless because you just like, well, I don't know what I can do. There's nothing that I could do to, you could go out and talk, and you could go out and try to work through things. And there's no way to beat it that I can see. And now they've established a drug court, and they think that's going to be the way to deal with it. And I think it's just another thing that they're propping up to say that they're doing something. But, you know, I don't know how much it's really helping in that.
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with slowing the flow down. No. It's coming across, the DEA says, the guys I talked to are like, it's out of control. From an administration point of view, there's nothing from top down that they're doing to really stop it, come across the border, and from China. And so it's open season, and it just continues to spread and permeate. And they're like, look, man, I work a job. I can't, we don't perform miracles here. We can do things based on what they give us, but they're not giving them much.
Some of the briefings that we get from the FBI, and they talk about how on the dark web, it's just general commerce, you know?
I mean,
you buy this stuff anyway, anyhow, and you know how to tag into it. You could get it, you know, like you're going to buy a bag of lollipops. It's that pervasive. So
shows up in the mail.
Yeah.
Literally like a box, like you order anything from Amazon or whatever, it just shows up in the mail and boom, right on your doorstep. I mean, it's,
and you know, as a father, you just beat yourself up so bad. Like, I know I could have done something. Why didn't I see this? Why were, you know, and you constantly go through that, and people tell you, you know, well, you know, it's not your fault. They made those decisions, you know, and whatever. And you're like, well, yeah, sure. But still, it was beyond their ability to crawl out of it. You know, if you drink like crazy and you get drunk every weekend and whatever, and you're like, you know, I got to stop this, or, you know, and you're an alcoholic, you know, there's like, it seems like there's a way that there's some way to get help. I mean, you can do that, but with this stuff, I don't see it. I don't see how anyone can move out of it once it gets a hold of you, because I've seen it, and it's dark, evil stuff.
When you see it in your job now, it's like a constant reminder. It's kind of like a punch in the face. You go to a scene, something happens with another youth, and you're like, you have to relive everything. It's like almost the definition of a nightmare, I would think.
Yeah, it is. And you hope that maybe by being there, you can help the family in some way for just a few moments and take them aside and talk to them about it. And, you know, if that's my lot, then that's what I'm going to do every time I can to help out. But I really, really feel for those who don't have a support structure, what that's got to be like.
Now, Rachel's feeling in rehab. It never really caught on, or the drugs were just so powerful it always lured her back. Is that,
she was so strong, she would be very successful in it, and she would go for a period of time, and then she would just exalt, you know, oh, I feel so great, it's so wonderful to be out of this, and you know, it's still a struggle, and I'm just day by day, and you know, but I'm trying, and you're like right there the whole time, you know, okay, let's, at one day at a time, we're going to get through this. And then all of a sudden disappear, you know, like she would, I'm going to go meet some friends. And then the next thing you're like, 2 days later, you know, you're frantic. Like, where did you go? What's going on? What's happening? And, you know, and then that's when she would fall back into it. And it had to be, you know, it was funny. I was talking to somebody one time. They were like, they said, I'm 26 years clean. And they said that, you know, that really is kind of not a comparable thing, because 26 years ago was, you know, a lot different.
Yeah.
But this person said that they would come to a stoplight and they would say to themselves, you know, if the third car is red that comes through the intersection, then I'm going to get high.
Yeah.
You know, like
they play little games.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought, I never heard that. And I was like, man, that's gotta be insane to
yeah.
have that constantly. So that I gained some perspective from that. And you know, I grew up in a place that I felt was pretty protective. You know, didn't see a lot of that stuff, and it was just the regular stuff. I, you know, it's suburbia, not the inner city. And you can understand that it must be, once it gets you bad. And there's a tremendous hole in the world where all of this takes place. And anybody that's in it, I really feel for them. Really, really deeply.
It's very hard to get out, man. It's very hard. I mean, I watched it growing up, and it's just like, dude, I always say, my old man had all his talent. He just couldn't get it together. Just, so come on, fucking get it together, man. Like, why can't you do this? Why can't you do that? And he just couldn't.
Yeah.
Sometimes the stuff is, that's the lure, man. It's, you know. And she said it herself, your daughter, it's 200 times. I mean, that's always going to pull her back. But you know, think about when you're talking and describing, I'm thinking about her. She has to kind of live in two different worlds. And she gets pulled back in, and she has to pretend that she didn't get pulled back in, come back to this. Everything physically that goes on with recovering, coming down, and then working and pretending that everything's under control. I mean, that's fucking hard. That's a miserable place to be. It's almost an impossible task.
A mental and physical yeah. juggernaut that you will never conquer.
Right.
And that's where it's at. And people come to me and they have, you know, their children that might be addicted, and they're like, this is what I'm dealing with. I don't know what to do and whatever. And the only thing I have left to tell them is you just tell them you love them and you know, are there to help them. And that's all you have. And hopefully with that can carry it. But it's way stronger than love, I think. And you are helpless, hopeless, and you deal with it by trying to live your life the best you can. So, to help others, that's where I'm at with it. And I hope that as we see the families dissolve in this mess that drugs have created, I think we need to focus on ways we can bring things to these children that will give them purpose beyond these drugs. I don't know what it is. And you could probably tell I'm so unable to put my thoughts together to discuss where all of this goes and what it means. I'm still in that process 5 years later. It was really difficult we just had the trial and the sentencing
of yeah.
the person who sold her the drugs, and it was only the second case of death resulting in drug delivery, that DRDD, and now there's hundreds of cases, but hers was the second case that had been prosecuted, and we were able to give victim statements, and the judge passed a sentence of a year in prison.
Anthony Variano was the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
a year, he said a year, 1 to 8 years, and the judge was conflicted because the guy had turned himself around and and so he was conflicted, and I don't know, as a father, I think I've been on both sides of the table in court, you know, that I would have been like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? I mean, he sold her this stuff. It was laced with fentanyl.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot, yeah. Obviously.
Even they had the text messages. It's like, hey, you got to go easy on this stuff because, you know, it's in there. And it's like, Jesus. You know, you knew that it was.
Well, they do it for an edge. You know, people are asking for it or they're seeking it out. And then these people don't know what they're getting. These dealers, they don't know how strong things are. And telling people, oh, go easy on it, that's not going to fucking work.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's not going to work. I mean, go easy on these folks are pedal to the metal. They're not going to go easy on anything. They're not going easy on themselves. They're looking for to not go easy. So it's a recipe for a complete chaos, you know, one way or another. But you said in court that you and your wife, and you were able to give public statements in court, and you said that you forgive him. I mean, that's something I don't think I would be even able to come to. That's a big, big, big thing.
Well, you know, it's part of my upbringing. You know, we are taught to be persons of compassion. And no matter what the circumstance, you know, allow the greater power to deal with it. And you don't want to become a part of this vicious world of retribution. And as much as you've tried not to go down that road, you just, it's an internal battle, you know. At one point, you're calling all your friends that you know and say, hey, make sure that, you know, if you get the opportunity, take care of some of this for me, you know.
Yeah.
And
you're talking about just overt violence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, if I get the opportunity, you know, what about if I'm out somewhere and it just by chance this thing happens, you know, and there's a confrontation. I know how to work through that. And, you know, just terrible accidents happen all the time. So
you're now in a fucking dark place.
Yeah.
It just, you know, you're talking about the dark place of your daughter and all these other things, the black hole, you say, and then you get sucked into it where you're thinking, I mean, you have a son, right?
So
so you get sucked into that, and if you take action, then you really...
That's probably...
Really what, got you.
That's probably what kept me away from doing that.
Your son.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly right. So. Yeah. Otherwise, you'd be like, okay, well, hey, you took something from me.
That's right.
I can return the favor.
Eye for an eye.
Yeah.
We'll settle this. Easy. It's not a difficult.
So how do you get from there to saying, you said, I forgive you, but you have to pay. And I'm thinking, I'm just thinking along the lines you're telling him in his life he has to pay.
Well, you know, I thought you go before this judge and you're going to give this statement. And if you say things that are, you just ramble on about how you destroyed this life and you destroyed our lives and you're going down this road. And I'm sure they've heard it 1,000 times. And I thought, you know, I need to make this resonate in a way that it is something that the judge, when he hears, he's going to be like, you know what? This guy's got to pay. And this is why he's got to pay. And the compassion of the parents, you know, deserve to have justice, and you have to pay. And really, afterwards, the prosecutor said, you know, he said, I've never heard these types of words before. And he says, I truly think, because just nobody gets time for these crimes, you know?
Yeah.
They think that, well, you know, that when they structured the sentencing, that it was probably a little harsh. It was more for the big time dealer, you know, those are the ones they were going after, not these people that are just peddling. And it's like, well, if you don't start with the people that are peddling, you know, then when you're not doing anything.
And but the judge even said that the big dealer is the one that should be sitting in the chair here, not this guy.
Yeah. I mean, there's still this, the person who committed the act.
Yeah.
You know, it's anything. It's like the first slash in a knife fight. You know, I mean, you've cut somebody. So, you know, you better be ready to pay, because that's what's going to happen. And I could never understand that kind of justice. It doesn't make sense. You know, justice is when somebody did something they shouldn't have been doing and has to pay for it. Not, you know,
let's make a deal and work our way up the ladder to the dealer, and he was cooperating. Why was he, we talked about this while he was in jail. Why? And I talked to guys in the DEA about it, right? You didn't ask me to do it. I just did it. I said, what's going on with this case? And I couldn't really get a definitive answer. And then I started to think, he's cooperating on some level. He must be, because this thing is, he's been, where is this case? He's been in jail and it's not moving.
Yeah.
And then you have this, you're out here with everything else you have to deal with emotionally, and then you're in some kind of a court limbo, and it just, there's no, if there can ever be any closure, which I doubt as a parent, but even the appearance of closure, you can't even get that. So what was going on?
So I think a couple things. The first one was the defense attorney, you know, when they would get to the point, you know, they'd file for an extension, and then we need some more time. And so you get so many of those, right? You know?
Oh, I know.
So
I know the game.
And then, so we're like at the last one, and it's like, there will be no further, you know, extensions. And sure enough, they dropped their defense attorney. Oh, well, now we got to start all over again.
Back to square one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had heard through the grapevine that there was probably, you know, that's part of the play, and that's what was going on. So I'm like, well, we're sticking with this. And then, you know, tragically, the lead detective on the case dies of some rare blood disease. He's like 52 years old. And now I'm like in a panic, you know, this guy was the one that was making this happen and, you know, and working this, and he has all the information, and where are we going to be? And luckily he was an impeccable detective and great notes, and he was able to pass it on, and we were able to continue, you know, without really losing much, but tragically, you know, the detective lost his life and his family and everything. I, you know, and it was personal because it was right here, you know, in the same city, and went to the funeral, and, you know, you had to deal with that. So never really knowing if there's going to be an end day, you know, it was very difficult. And then there was some talk about there was some money, you know, they had some money, and so they were able to get a good defense, and you know, they were playing it every way they can. And then somehow they said he got employment and he got a union card and he was working as a plumber. And I found out that I don't think he ever worked a day as a plumber, you know, but that was what they were laying out.
That was a defense.
Yeah. Laying out that he turned his life around and he got a union card and now he's going to do this. But I get no evidence that he was working anywhere, doing anything, you know, when he was able to get out. So
he's locked up now, right?
Yeah. And it's crazy. Just an hour ago, I got a notification that he's been moved from one prison to Camp Hill. And I'm not sure why he got moved or what's going on with that, but you know, sometimes, you know, they move people for certain reasons. So,
well, if he's going to Camp Hill, that's probably much more harsh or harsher environment than where he was.
Yeah.
Camp Hill is not, it's not like FCI Loretto.
Yeah, right. That's right. Marion Barry, right?
Yeah, Marion Barry and Paul Manafort and many others went to FCI. But so you're dealing, you're almost living on a razor blade, and any slip in many different areas just can be just devastating as a father. You have the court, you have the jockeying going on behind the scenes with this guy trying to get out, you know, of what he did. Then you have everything you have to deal with as a father, the loss. And what about rage? You know, I've known you for a long time, and I would take you for the guy that would be just what you did. Rage at the front end and then measured response after you calm down.
Yeah. You scream, you know, her name. I screamed her name like 500 times, you know. And then there's times where you're driving and you don't know where you're driving to. What's, you know, why, what am I doing? And that's, some of that is the rage boiling up. And then there's life events that occur that you want to share, and all of that's gone. So anybody that's tragically lost somebody, you know, has gone through that. And so I always try to turn to things. I'm like, you know, well, there's somebody that is going to jail for her death. All right. A lot of people don't have that. They don't
get anything.
Yeah. They get nothing. So I'm like, you know, that to me is some retribution for that. And so I guess I just try to look at all the positive things in my life, because if you don't, then you'll dissolve into that dark hole. And, you know, I just feel like I'm really glad I didn't start drinking, or I didn't get into anything that was, you know, that started to deteriorate my life. I poured myself into my work and did that. And, you know, I've had a lot of accomplishments in work. So that's come from that, you know, drive probably. That's my addiction, you know.
Yeah.
This is working. And so that's where I'm at today with all of it. But, it, you know, it's 10 years, you know, 5 years of addiction that she battled, and then 5 years of this case. So 10 years of my life really been.
Doesn't seem like 10 years at the time, though. It's like, but when you look back on it, you're like, holy shit, that's fucking a decade. I've been doing this for a decade.
Yeah.
You just get so used to living in the struggle, living in the day to day. You know, you lose track of how long it is when you live on a day to day basis.
I had a crazy tragedy in one calendar year from on the same day to date. I lost five people. My grandmother, who I spent my summers with, my uncle, who was a mentor. I had a personal mentor, and then my mother and father died 10 days apart. And this all happened in one calendar year. And I think going through all that tragedy, I think is another piece of the puzzle that allowed me to be able to work through this. But there's so much death and tragedy that I've seen in my job that, I've probably compartmentalized it there too. And if I ever get the opportunity to help somebody, going through a tragic circumstance, I really try to help them. It's one of the things that maybe that's my life's work to do. So
your parents died 10 days apart. That's the kind of stuff you used to read about in Reader's Digest. These folks. I mean, you come from a long line of troublemakers out here.
Yeah.
It's telling true. Me.
Yeah, the history books show our family lineage rolling into town and causing hell and then leaving in its wake a mess and then come back. So you get one page in the history books for that. But my dad was 59 and my mother was 56. And my mother was diagnosed with cancer, and she had best care in the world, Mayo Clinic, Minnesota. And she came home for hospice, and we just got her set up, and I got a phone call, and my dad had a heart attack and died. So it was like, and then she died within the next week from cancer.
Did it prepared you for what you had to go through with your daughter?
Yeah. And it was the strangest thing, the book of Job